It's so nice to be here and talk about this complicated topic near and dear to our hearts, and I have no conflicts. So I was at a conference once where they said they were going to give you a dollar every time you presented the care cascades. So here's my care cascades. I'll wait for my dollar. But everyone knows, and the reason we're here today is that we're not doing as well as we would like in engaging people in care and having them on antiretroviral therapy. And so for about the last 6 years ago, we've been trying to understand why that might be the case. And we're really interested in difference by racial ethnic groups. We don't do well with any group, but some of the most vulnerable in our country tend to do worse. So you see 21% virally suppressed among African Americans, 26% among Latinos. And so we asked some questions in a recent research study. What's impeding the uptake of antiretroviral therapy? What factors are most important and how do they operate? Also, what are we missing and are there junctures or opportunities for intervention? So we had an R34 study, which is a pilot exploratory study, and we went after people, adults who had CD4s of less than 500, African American and Latino, and the reason we do that is because we do culturally targeted interventions who'd been on HIV but were not taking any antiretroviral therapy. And for this small study, we looked at people who could conduct activities in English. And there's two main pathways that get in the way of antiretroviral therapy. I think the first one is the best known, which is if you're not in HIV care, you're not going to get access to antiretroviral therapy. But the second one is something that I'm more interested in, is that people who have barriers to antiretroviral therapy, or they've stopped taking it and they haven't told their provider, or they never took it, or they don't want to take it, avoid HIV care. And these people actually don't turn up in regular care settings so much, and relatively little is known about them. So as I said, they're not found in clinics, so how did we go after them? We used peers as our sort of expert panel, and we went into some venues where we were told they could be found, and then we did a lot of peer-to-peer recruitment to enroll our sample. So here's the study. It's called Heart to Heart. We recruited, as I said, in clinics and peers. We did a structured baseline interview with 95, and then we did qualitative interviews grounded in the theory of triadic influence, which is a social cognitive theory, with 39 of them. And this is the model that we came up with, actually based on the literature mainly, and the preliminary studies we've done with this population. So why don't people take antiretroviral therapy? So it's very multi-level at the individual level. I'm going to just hit the high points because we don't have time to get everything. I would say that emotions are very big. People are afraid. They're afraid of so many things. They're afraid of side effects. That's the thing people like to talk about most. But they're afraid of stigma. They're afraid of the implications in their life. And then there's a lot of distrust, of course, grounded in our history as the nation that has maltreated populations of color in medical research. But at the same time, you have distrust, you also have hope and intrinsic motivation for health. Some people don't think antiretroviral therapy works or that they need it. They may not think that they can handle it, which is self-efficacy, and then substance use and mental health get in the way. And then at the social level, there's social norms, and I'll talk about some of these things in our findings. Relationships with providers tend to be strained. A lot of them trust their providers, but if you're not taking antiretroviral therapy, you're not doing what your provider feel strongly you should do in most cases, and that is a stressor on the relationship. And then just the short appointment time doesn't allow providers to address these barriers. I mean, no one could really address these barriers in 7 minutes or 10 minutes. So here's our sample. We had a lot of differences between the clinic recruited group, which was 35 people, in the community group. Just very briefly, it was very, very hard to recruit in clinics. This population really is not found in clinics. So if you're interested in people not on antiretroviral therapy, don't look for them in clinics. You know, they're out in the community. So they're on the older side, mostly male. The males are about 60% were men who have sex with men, mostly African American, very, very few employed, all of them low socioeconomic status, and substance use issues were common, some kind of substance use issue, and about a third had injected drugs in their lifetime, and 45% in the community cohort had depression at a clinically significant level. So that's a lot of risk right there. And then in terms of their health, they had been living with HIV for a long time. The community cohort, 16 years. On average, they've been living with HIV, and a lot of them had tried to take antiretroviral therapy, so You see 62% had tried to take it. Some of them had tried to take it many, many times, sometimes stopping after a few days, sometimes stopping after a year, and they'd had AIDS diagnoses. 27% were selling medications. So what happens there is you go to fill your prescription and the pharmacy offers, the pharmacy offers you $120 for your prescription and you need it. You know, this is a very low income population. It's too tempting to say no. And if you have substance use issues, that can complicate things even further. And only 45% in the community reported seeing a primary care provider in the past year. That probably underestimates engagement in care, but they didn't have an identified primary care provider. In terms of why they stopped antiretroviral therapy, this is from the quantitative data among those who had taken it. It's a lot of barriers, I think, that could be overcome. So a lot of barriers that suggest lack of preparation and lack of readiness. And life and things that probably could be predicted. They even said, 48.7% in the community said, I wasn't ready, I changed my mind. Substance use is a large barrier, life circumstances changed. But, the community cohort tended to have more of these barriers related to instability and, losing housing and whatnot than the clinic. The clinic tended to be a little more stable. All right, so this is that was our quantitative research, just very briefly, and here's our qualitative research, which I think is much more interesting. We decided to tell you today about the most frequently cited barriers. I think the most frequently cited barriers are probably some of the primary ones in the minds of people living with HIV/AIDS. So they said the main ones were I feel healthy, and I'll go into all of these in a little bit of detail. Substance use, side effects, medical distrust, and preference for alternative treatments. So just briefly, what we know about how these barriers operate. Well, first, to complicate matters, these barriers operate in a historical and cultural context. And I think it's worth mentioning, because these factors they're influencing us on a daily basis, and we're struggling with these in our work. So some of the main ones are past and present structural racism, which represents as exclusion and discrimination. Poverty and competing priorities is a huge barrier, but inequality is a huge barrier. It's one thing if we're all in it together and we're all struggling, but it's another thing if I'm struggling and you drive by me on the street with an $80,000 watch and a $100,000 car, and then you feel the unfairness of it. And then at the bottom, a lot of barriers that I won't have time to get into today, but they create obstacles to going on antiretroviral therapy. Changing antiretroviral guidelines hit early, hit hard, then everyone should be on it. And then it was 200, then it was 350, now it's 500. That creates mistrust. The early antiretroviral regimens were very strong, some would say toxic. People have not forgotten that stigma, which is a whole conference in and of itself. In New York City, the benefits improve when you get an AIDS diagnosis. That's unintended consequences. Of that policy, people will wait to go on antiretroviral therapy until they have an AIDS diagnosis because then their benefits improve. And just seeing that people of color are overrepresented in HIV/AIDS cases makes people question, well, why is that? It's what we sometimes call conspiracy theories. My goal for myself is going to come up with a better term for that before I speak on this topic again. But just wondering, well, why did this happen? It raises mistrust. All right, so to tell you more about the barriers that they mentioned. So feeling healthy, basically, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And this is something that's very common. So you're minding your own business, you feel healthy, someone told you have a chronic life-threatening condition, someone told you your numbers are such and such, but you don't feel it. And it's hard to get, with all these other barriers, to get your head around the fact that you should take a medicine that actually will probably make you feel worse for a little bit, and so you don't. Second, substance use. This is very, very complicated, but I'm just going to hit some of the high points or the low points. So how does substance use get in the way of antiretroviral therapy? Well, one is people are afraid of the interactions between street drugs and antiretroviral therapy, but they can't really talk about it with their providers because the providers think they're not on substances or they told them not to take substances. There's not really anywhere they can go with this for medical information. And similar, that the substance use makes them fear that they won't be able to commit to antiretroviral therapy. They know that if they're going to have to do it, they're going to have to do it for life. And I'm not sure I can do it. And then it also taps into the emotions underlying HIV, which I don't think we talk enough about. I think our work on adherence and other issues have been much more cognitive than emotional. And I think that the emotions, what it feels like to take that pill every day, and how it makes you address your HIV is really potent for a lot of people. So how do they talk about stigma? Okay, so if I'm the type of person in a suit and tie and I'm HIV, the doctor's going to respect me more than a person that, hey, I used drugs yesterday. If you're a drug addict, I know I don't give a shit about explaining nothing to you. So that actually is nothing new. That's something that's well documented in the literature. So what about side effects? Side effects is kind of interesting because it actually taps into historical trauma where people remember when people got AZT in the 80s, and there's many stories of people, they turned ashy, they turned blue, their lips turned blue, they died. And it seems to have become almost a social norm that antiretroviral therapy is toxic. And that needs to be addressed. And then I told you a lot of people have tried antiretroviral therapy in the past. Well, if they tried it in the 80s or even the early 90s, they may have had side effects that they wouldn't have if they had taken it today. I mean, the antiretroviral regimens today are I know the goal is them to be tolerable, but they are much, much, much more tolerable than before, and some people don't really have any side effects, so that's a huge difference from before. So they've seen side effects in others, and it taps into fear, just fatalism, depression. You know, is it even worth it to do this? And not understanding what side effects mean. Side effects are not bad. Side effects tell you that a strong medicine is working, but people don't always interpret it that way. Okay, picking up the pace. Okay, medical distrust. They'll say pharma is getting rich off patients. Okay, that's true. That's fine. We don't have to argue with that. But that doesn't mean that the medications aren't going to be your best chance for a long and healthy life. As I mentioned before, the changing ART guidelines, people will say, well, I feel like a guinea pig. You know, they keep changing it. I'm not really sure what I should do. And then historical reasons not to trust. And then the last one, preference for alternative treatments. This taps into cultural norms and age-related norms. And all of these are very powerful and potentially potent opportunities for intervention. So this one woman said, it'd be like, well, okay, you take HIV meds. Which one are you using? Oh, don't take those medicines. No, if I tell my aunt, you know, my great aunties, no, don't take those medicines. What you need is some ginger. You need to come over, get home remedies and stuff. So, you know, it's a generation thing. It's a cultural thing. It's so many different things. So let's revisit our model, and I highlighted in orange what the barriers were that the population pointed out to us were most active. I wouldn't assume that other barriers are not active, and I think in fact, we don't see structural barriers often, but we're very in touch with individual barriers, but this is the perspective of people living with HIV/AIDS. And the study also highlighted some facilitators, housing and material needs, we know that. Being treated as a whole person, and the importance of relationships and trust, and the importance of dealing with fear and feelings. When I put this PowerPoint together, I started to feel like this was very hopeless. But obviously, it's not hopeless, and we've seen many successes in our field to bring people into care and to get them on antiretroviral therapy. And in fact, we just completed an intervention called Heart to Heart. I'm not going to talk about today, but I just wanted to tell you about it. You can look for it in the literature, where we tried to address these barriers that I told you about in a multi-component intervention. It was very promising. And with that, I'll say thank you, and this is our research team.
Questions from the room?
Can you talk more about the pharmacies getting money for the prescriptions from that?
Sure. I didn't know about this. Actually, some people call it diversion. It is in the literature, so we're not the first to hear about it. But it's illegal, obviously. The pharmacies open and close quickly because the federal and local authorities are onto them. They either bill Medicaid for medications they didn't give, or they repackage medications and sell them internationally. And we have had people doing it for 13 years, you know, 10 years. It's really, for us, it's a real big problem. The good news is, for whatever reason, the price has dropped, and that, to us, creates opportunities to intervene with people. So now it's getting to the point where it might not be worth it. But still, we intervene with people who have been selling, and you know, we use a motivational interviewing framework and help people just weigh their decisions and decide is this better for you to keep doing this, or do you want to make the switch and start taking the medications? But I'll tell you, there's a lot of frustrated providers out there writing prescriptions every 3 to 6 months that they know their people are not taking. So we had the, actually I agree with you overall, but we had the opposite experience for this study. When we would approach people in the clinic, they would run the other way. If they're not a medication in the clinic, they don't want to hear about it. So we did some in-person recruitment, but mainly it was peer-to-peer. And that's just tremendously powerful where the peer basically endorses, like, you know what, they're okay, they're not going to try to pressure you, you know, it's not going to be a bad experience. That's what people are, they're really afraid to be pressured, they're afraid to feel bad, they're afraid to, you know, get in trouble. So the peers open the door for us.
Thank you.